I would like to hope that my absence increases your affection for me as it does as much as it does my affection for you. It's always good to get back and to sing with you and to join in the prayers that you brethren lead so well and say amen with the men who say amen at the close of the prayers, unlike in so many congregations. It's always good to speak to you because you listen better than most other congregations to whom I speak. I did, however, have a very fine meeting over in North Carolina, a number of connections with Ember Hills one way or another. Many of them have visited here at one time or the other, but Hugh and Laura Parks were there nearly every service. They don't actually attend there, but they drove a number of miles to be there, and many of you who are members of this congregation will certainly remember them. Jeff Young and his family were there on Friday night from Winston-Salem, and ask that they be remembered to this congregation. We had splendid attendance through the week, people driving from considerable distances. It's a good, strong congregation in an area where there are not many churches like that. And many of the members drive considerable distances to be there to serve the Lord in the manner that they believe He would have them serve. And I was very much encouraged by that meeting, but as I said, certainly glad to be home. I'll be here for several Sundays, Lord willing, and look forward to that. I'd like to read a portion of Scripture from the 45th chapter of the book of Genesis this morning, reading beginning with verse 25 and reading through verse 28. Then they went up out of Egypt, that is, the brothers of Joseph, and came to the land of Canaan to Jacob their father. And they told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart stood still, because he could not believe them. But when they told him all the words which Joseph had said to them, and when he saw, this translation says, the carts, the King James says, the wagons which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. Then Israel said, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go see him before I die. Bible students will recognize the background of these words, of course. You remember that Joseph was Jacob's favorite son, and he bestowed an unusual number of benefits and kindnesses upon Joseph. But Joseph's brothers were jealous of him. And when they had an opportunity, they put him in a pit and then sold him to merchants who were on their way to Egypt, so that he was taken to Egypt and made a slave. They really didn't know what had become of Joseph, but they were afraid of what their father might do to them. And so they took Joseph's coat and dipped it in the blood of an animal. And Jacob, of course, drew the conclusion that Joseph had been killed by some wild beast. He just knew that Joseph was dead. Some years later, though, when Joseph had been made governor of the land of Egypt and there was a great famine in the land, these brothers went to Egypt to obtain food. And even though they saw Joseph, they didn't recognize him. It didn't even occur to them that he might be in such a high position. Joseph didn't reveal himself to them at first, but when they came for their second trip, he told them who he was and sent for his father to come and join him in the land of Egypt. The father was just sure that Joseph was dead. And in this text we've read, they came back saying that Joseph was still alive, and he didn't believe them. But they told him the words that Joseph had said, and then he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent. And when he saw those wagons, he knew there was no other explanation for them. And so his confidence in the existence of his son and the life of his son returned, and he rejoiced and went to meet his son in Egypt. There are many things that I've been thinking about all my life. Most of my life, of maturity at least, I've been studying the Bible. And I believe the words that I have read there. I've endeavored many times to try to picture the circumstances under which various events took place, and the land in which they occurred. But it's been very difficult for me to imagine. But in the 2 weeks before I went to the meeting in North Carolina, the Griffins and Kaneda and I were able to travel into the land where most of those events took place. And we saw wagons everywhere. It fit with what I had seen in the Bible precisely and exactly. And it was an increasing joy to me to see that things fit so perfectly with what we had studied in the Bible all of our lives. I think all of us have dreamed of that time and when Gideon took his men down to the spring as the Midianites were gathered out in the valley, and he had them to drink at the spring, and the manner in which they drank determined which ones would fight the battle and which ones would be sent home. Well, we went by that very spring, and there it was, and you could see the valley out there right where the Midianites were gathered, and this was a reminder of this story, and it just fits so perfectly with the geography, the scene that was there. Right behind us, in fact, the spring was flowing out of Mount Gilboa, and I remembered the study I'd done and the lessons I'd taught again and again about Saul facing the Philistines and being driven back up toward Mount Gilboa and hiding and disguising himself and going through the Philistines' lines over to the witch of Endor. And right around the hill there was Endor, where the witch had lived. And there was Mount Gilboa, on which Saul had killed himself and on which his son Jonathan was killed. And you could just go on and on with those things that were so familiar. I've thought about Jezreel, where Ahab had his palace, and Jezebel, his wife, looking out down the valley and seeing someone coming, and they said, it's Jehu because he drives furiously. I've heard some people say that was the first preacher because preachers drive furiously. I don't know. But you could just, we stood up there on the hill of Jezreel and looked down the valley, and you could understand how for miles away, even a horseman could be seen coming, and if they were familiar with the driving of Jehu, then they would recognize who it was and know really something of the purpose for which he was coming. But I suppose that Jerusalem is of interest to most people, and I was indeed interested in Jerusalem. I could see how Joab could climb up through that channel, as it was described, up into the city and take it even behind the wall. And then Marty made mention just a few moments ago of the purchase of the field of Ornan. And I remember the story as David was down in that little spur of a hill that was his city. And he saw the angel of the Lord with his sword over Jerusalem. And he went up from Jerusalem. And you usually think of Jerusalem as being at the highest point, but not the city of David. It was down rather low. But he went up from the city back onto a higher hill right behind the city, and there he purchased the threshing floor of Ornan and later built a temple there. And as we stood down, and we could look down at this little city of David, but there behind us was the prominence on which the temple had been built. And really there was still the platform, not the temple, but there was the platform that had Solomon had begun and then had been enlarged by Herod for the temple to which Jesus came. But the temple wasn't there because Jesus said not a stone of the temple would be left on top of the other. But there were the stones of the platform, and there was the great platform on which the church was established on the day of Pentecost. I had read in 2 Chronicles, the 32nd chapter, of the building of a second wall by Hezekiah. And we looked, and way down low there, where archaeologists had dug down into the ground, was the remains of that wall that Hezekiah had built. And this morning in our study, we talked about the burning of the city of Jerusalem. And at one spot where the archaeologists had worked, there were the blackened stones and what appeared to be almost the ashes of a city that had been burned. And the archaeologists traced it back and said this is precisely the time when the Babylonians burned the city of Jerusalem. There's really little there to identify with Jesus. It's interesting to know that the ground on which Jesus walked was some 15 or 20 feet below the present level of the city. Many people see pictures of the Via Dolorosa and they suppose Jesus walked those very same streets. No, where Jesus walked is way down below. But there were a few things that one could not fail to remember in connection with Jesus. Acts 1:12 speaks of the Mount of Olives from which he ascended as being a Sabbath day's journey from Jerusalem. And if you stood at the wall of Jerusalem, over there about 3/4 of a mile or so, is indeed the Mount of Olives. And on the side there are the olive trees, perhaps where Jesus prayed, if not precisely the spot, certainly an area of olive trees very similar to the Garden of Gethsemane. And just this morning we read about Josiah in the class looking over there and seeing the tombs on the hill opposite Jerusalem. And it is still covered with tombs, old tombs and graves where people have been buried. But I say again that somehow the city of Jerusalem didn't connect me with Jesus as much as, well, as Galilee. This was a most encouraging opportunity for me to be able to visit that part of the world. And I just could not believe the compactness of it. We read about Tiberias, and we read about Capernaum, and we read about Bethsaida, and somehow or other, that just seems to me like a wide range of country. But as we looked, well, let me just say it this way. If you drew a line from here, roughly up to Peachtree Industrial, and made a lake cover that line, go along that line, you would just about have the cities in which most of Jesus' ministry was performed, between here and Peachtree Industrial, if you can believe that. I'd read that all my life, that it was just 2 miles or something from this place to another, but I just couldn't believe it till I looked at that and saw. And if you can imagine then a hill rising to 300 or 400 feet behind the little cities, well, they were pretty good-sized cities in those times. It was a busy area. Beautiful area, though, on the Sea of Galilee. If you can imagine a hill rising above that into which he could go and pray, and on which perhaps the Sermon on the Mount was preached, and you can stand up there, and there's Capernaum there, and just around the corners, Bethsaida, just across where the Jordan goes into the Sea of Galilee, and there's Dalmanutha and Magdala and those cities that were so prominent. And over there, just a short distance, is Tiberias, where Herod actually had his palace. And he could look across the sea and see those multitudes over there on the hills as they were listening to Jesus preach. Such a compact area, such a small area. And yet it has changed, without doubt, the history of the world. I was thrilled with the quietness of it in comparison to Jerusalem. Jerusalem these days is an armed camp. There are soldiers everywhere with rifles and peeping over the walls and looking at from places that you didn't dream there would be a soldier, and there he is looking at you. And it must have been much the same way in Jesus' day with the soldiers that were there from the Roman army, the Roman camp, right there in a tower right next to Jerusalem. And not only that, but there were traders that were pressing themselves on us, trying to sell postcards and wooden camels and all this kind of thing, totally commercialized. And I could imagine the anger when I wanted to meditate just a little bit. This was being pressed on me, and I could just imagine Jesus going into the temple and hearing these hawkers and these traders as they were changing money. And I could understand why Jesus said when he arose from the dead that his disciples should meet him in Galilee. He'd want to go back up into the hills and back up into that beautiful little sea on which he had spent so much of his life. We went from there to Athens, and I've thought so often of Paul seeing the city wholly given to idolatry, and sure enough, as the guide explained this temple and that temple, each one was for a god or a goddess, and I heard the names of gods and goddesses that I didn't even know existed. And you can understand Paul's anxiety and concern when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. And then down to Corinth, and Paul spoke about the meat that was sold in the shambles that had been sacrificed to idols, and there were the marketplaces right there in the city of Corinth that had been restored by the archaeologists, and the platform where the governor sat when Paul was brought right before him. Now, these things don't give us, the word gives us faith. The word of Joseph caused Jacob to believe. But the wagons just reinforced because they fit with the words. And that's what I'm telling you about what we saw and what so many others, some of you have seen. But it just fits so perfectly with the words. And it just occurred to me that
Many people talk about Bible stories as being myths or fables, but you don't go to places where myths and fables have taken place and see the geography and the locations that fit so perfectly with those myths and fables. It's just somewhere in a land far away at a time long ago. But here we can pinpoint the time and the place and the dates where many, many things have taken place. But I want to make a second observation. When Jacob saw those wagons, he didn't go out and hug and kiss them. The only significance they had was that they reminded him of his son and increased his confidence that his son was still alive. And I think one of the depressing things to me about this whole experience was that people were worshiping the places where some of these things were supposed to have taken place. They actually chose the places that are less certain in many instances than those that are certain. But they were worshiping them. We went to the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. And going through this big church, some of us climbed down the steps to what was a cave. And there is a silver star where Jesus is supposed to have been born. This tradition goes all the way back to the 4th century. But still, it's uncertain. But here were people kissing the star, and they had candles burning everywhere and all kinds of evidences of respect for the place in a very special way. And there was a family there, and they were trying to get a teenager to reach down and kiss the star, and she didn't want to do it. And the family got rather upset with her because she wouldn't kiss the star where Jesus was supposedly born. And in Nazareth, we dodged the traffic and the postcard sellers and the camel sellers to get into a little church building and go back into a place where there was a spring, which was the center of the church. And that was the well of Nazareth, where Jesus perhaps drew water. We don't know. But the people were worshiping the place. And most disturbing of all to me was what's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Here was a little building that was built over the place where Jesus was supposedly buried. And you could go inside and find what was supposed to be the tomb of Jesus. We didn't even go inside. I think it would have been a disturbing experience for me. But around this small building, there is a much larger building. But different churches and different nationalities, the Armenians and the Coptics and the Romans and the Turks and various other, not the Turks, but the Orthodox Church, they have fought and fussed about that little building so much that they say that today even fistfights occur because one group thinks that the other group is imposing upon their rights near this Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And each of these different groups has some part in this larger building that covers this little building. And some parts of it are highly decorated, but other parts are totally neglected because of arguments over who has the rights and who has the responsibility to repair it. And it was just a hubbub right there also around the place where Jesus was supposedly buried and raised. Not only are there fistfights today, but there have been wars over this matter. Back in the early part of this millennium, there were the Crusades, 200 years of wars. Thousands of people dying so that so-called Christians could reclaim the holy places from the Mohammedans and they would be able to go there and worship. And there were even crusades by children in which children went to fight against the Turks to try to take away from their control these places. And blood has been shed so very abundantly just to try to maintain these places. And then I thought about all of that. I thought about the superiority of God's arrangement. And I can tell you right now that sitting here with you, partaking of the Lord's Supper, after thoughtful comments have been made and prayers have been prayed, I get much closer to the Lord than I could in the church of the Holy Sepulchre. Because Jesus taught that it's not the place that matters. He told the woman of the well, the time is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall men worship the Father. He didn't mean they couldn't worship in that mountain or couldn't worship in Jerusalem, but he was saying these places have no advantage over any other place. He said those that worship the Father must worship him in spirit and in truth, for it is such that the Father seeks to worship him. I believe the visiting those places has value, but they have no significance to God whatsoever. The city of Jerusalem, that many people still believe has some kind of special place in the mind of God, is really a rather unpleasant place to be in many respects. But that's not our Jerusalem. And I'm thankful to God that we have a better Jerusalem. Hebrews, the 12th chapter in verse 22 says, "You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel." Our city of Jerusalem is heaven. And our king is Jesus Christ, and he's reigning now, and we're citizens of that kingdom. And the geographical place on this earth makes no difference, but we worship him in spirit and in truth. I want to use one other passage, a little out of context, but I think it has meaning at this particular juncture. In the book of John, the 20th chapter, we have that account of Thomas' desire to see Jesus and to put his hand into his side and into the wounds of his hands. And Jesus insisted that he do that, even though after seeing Jesus, he did not seem to think that this was of necessity. But Jesus insisted that he do it. And he said to him, "Thomas, you have seen me, you have believed, but blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed." I'm thankful I could go, and I know that many others have gone, and I hope that some of you may be able to go someday. But that doesn't make me any better Christian than those who've never gone. And I think that's an important thing to remember. Some years ago, I had opportunity to be associated with the Muslims in some large degree. And there were certain ones that were Al-Hajjah. You may see that title sometime. And what that means is they have been to Mecca. And that makes them just a little bit better than any of the other Muslims among whom they're associated. We have no title that says we have been to Jerusalem or been to Galilee or any other such place. Some people who go don't see anything of significance at all. And it's interesting to me that 70% of the people in that land are irreligious. And after seeing the fights among various religious groups and the tensions that exist among those even who claim to believe in Jesus, I think it's understandable that 70% of the people are not religious people. My father never went, but he taught me an awful lot about the land, and I'll have to admit that place after place where I went and saw, I could remember the words my father had spoken, talking about those places as though he had been there. He had been there with the eye of faith. And I'm going to try not to bore you with stories of the place I've been. And I hope, in fact, this is probably going to be the last thing I'm going to say about it, as far as actually describing my experiences and what I saw. We were told about a story Brother Yeter Tant had told while he was over there about a church that was looking for a preacher. And there were three qualifications for that preacher. First of all, he must be one who did not know Greek. And second, he must be one who had never written a book. And third, he must be one who had never been to the Holy Land, as they put it. They'd just heard about those things till they were sick of them. And I don't want to make you sick of it. But I do hope that the opportunity of seeing those things, which I've had and some others of you have had, will help them to be a little more real in our own mind and may help us just a little bit better to impart to you some concept, some picture of that land that does exist and those places that are real, where real men and real women served God and served Him effectively for our example. I'm going to conclude with one more observation. Though I have described the compactness of the land, I still could not help but realize what Jesus had experienced. We live in a land of so much prosperity. Mention has been made of that this morning twice already, in the prayer and in the comments. And life is so easy for us. We could get on a bus, an air-conditioned bus, and ride along to Jerusalem in just a little while from Galilee, and then get out and go in and get a nice hot shower and stay in a comfortable hotel, air-conditioned, everything perfectly comfortable for us. But I tell you, it wasn't that way when Jesus was there. The city of Capernaum, where Jesus made His home, was a fairly large city and not a bad city. And yet we visited some building projects where Jesus may have been engaged as a carpenter in His first 30 years. And here were these huge stones and pieces of wood, the kind of thing He would have possibly handled in His work as a carpenter, without the kind of equipment that we have now that makes our work so much easier. The little houses, the stone houses in which people lived in Capernaum, have been unearthed. And you can see the foundations and even the walls. The rooms were very small. The houses were very rude in which they lived. We got rather tired of fish. We ate fish in the morning and fish at night. It was fish, fish, fish. We did have some choices, but I suspect Jesus ate fish far more often than we did over a period of years because, well, that's what was available. And while we took our journey in buses that could move along at 30 or 40 miles an hour, 50, even if the traffic was not too bad, Jesus walked. And from Galilee to Jerusalem was 85 miles, 4 or 5 days' journey. And as a rule, He went through Jericho, and along that road from Jerusalem to Jericho, or from Jericho to Jerusalem, as the case might be, that we've heard of so often with reference to Samaria. And it was a climb of nearly 4,000 feet, the 17 miles from the Dead Sea and the level of Jericho on up to Jerusalem. And as we rode up there and shifted gears down and shifted gears down, I could just think of what it meant for Him to walk up those hills, to experience the dangers that were involved of them, and particularly how heavy the load must have been as He walked from Jericho to Jerusalem, knowing the things that awaited Him in the city of Jerusalem. And you know, when you've known a better, I suspect it would have been hard. It would be harder for me to live that way than it would have been for Peter or John, because Peter or John have never known the comforts that I know, riding in buses and air-conditioned places to sleep and nice hot showers and the luxuries that I know. And going from a life like that of luxury and convenience and comfort to hardships such as I've described would have been very, very difficult for them. But they had never known that. And so it must have been not as hard for them. But Jesus had known it. Jesus had known something far, far better than I know. Something better than you know. You may have a fine home, and you may have a comfortable automobile, and you may have fine clothes to wear, and all kinds of evidences of prosperity. But Jesus had far more than we have now in heaven. But He left it all and came down and lived on the Sea of Galilee among fishermen. He served and worked as a carpenter. He walked the dusty roads. He faced all the hardships of living in those little rocked houses. and of having to climb with his own feet up the hill of that led of the wilderness of Judea that led to Jerusalem, there to die on a cross for you and me. And when I think about what he endured, what it meant for him to leave heaven and to be a man living in such times as he lived, in such a place as he lived, I thank him, I praise him, and I rejoice that we can come a little closer to him, maybe through seeing the land, but even more through reading his precious word. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. He, though rich, became poor for our sakes, that we, through his poverty, might be rich. Is there someone here this morning who loves the Lord and has faith enough in him from the word that's been spoken to be willing to give up something for him? We'll have to give up something. There's no way you can follow Jesus without some sacrifice on your part. He spoke of it as taking up a cross. Are you willing to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow him who loved you enough to give up everything to live and die for you? If you're here with that disposition and attitude, your faith is such, your penitence such, if you're willing to confess him before men and to be buried with him in baptism and raised to a new life, we'd like to assist you in that. We want to encourage you to do it and help you in every way we can. And we sing this song to encourage you to come and let your desires be known.